You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We are continuing our history series, The Battle for the Augsburg Confession, with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. We'll get to that in just a moment. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University Irvine. You can learn more about Concordia University Irvine at cui.edu. Joining us today, again, is Dr. Cameron McKenzie, the Forrest E. and Francis H. Ellis Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne. Welcome back to The Coffee Hour, Dr. McKenzie.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here again.
So this is episode 2 in our series. In our first episode, we covered the history of the Augsburg Confession in Germany. And I believe today we are coming across the ocean. Is that right?
We sure are. Yep, we are. Right.
Okay. So what happens to the Augsburg Confession? What is that transition period of when the first Lutherans start to bring this theology and the legal and theological document across the ocean to America?
Yeah. Well, it's good to remember now that by the time we have run through the 16th century, big chunks of the German-speaking world have become Lutheran as defined by adherence to the Augsburg Confession. And indeed, after 1580, basically adherence to the entire Book of Concord. A book, however, composers contended that what they were putting together was the theology of the Augsburg Confession. The whole Book of Concord is thought of as being expressive of that first document, the Augsburg Confession. Not all German speakers, of course, became Lutheran. In the South, particularly, Catholicism remained strong in the official religion of some of the territories like Bavaria. But it was also true that by the time we get to the end of the 16th century, some of the German territories had adopted the Reformed faith, and they can be defined by several different documents, but the one that's usually characteristic of the German Reformed is the Heidelberg Catechism. Lutherans have the Luther Catechism, German Reformed have the Heidelberg Catechism. So potentially, when we get immigrants from the German-speaking world, they could be Reformed, Catholic, or Lutheran. However, in the colonial period, there aren't very many Catholics coming. So you do get German Reformed and German Lutherans when Germans start to migrate. And there are a few Germans who come in the century, but the bulk of the German migration to America during the colonial period comes in the 18th century, really a generation or two before the American Revolution. And they settle largely in the middle colonies, I think Pennsylvania especially, but also New York. And there are some in the South. There are some in the Carolinas, for example, in Virginia and Georgia. So there are Germans who come in significant numbers to America. Most of them come from territories that are either Reformed or Lutheran. And of course, they bring their church inheritance along with them, with everything else that they bring from the old country. I should mention also that whenever you get Scandinavians coming to America, they're going to be coming with their brand of Lutheranism as well. And during the colonial period, early in the colonial period, we got some Swedes settling along the Delaware River. You do get Lutherans then coming to North America. The Swedes actually do come in a movement that's authorized and blessed by the monarch. And so the monarch actually continues through the colonial period on a regular basis to send Swedish Lutheran pastors to that handful of Swedish Lutheran congregations that settled along the Delaware River, the colony of Delaware, the state of Delaware, and then later Pennsylvania. But that's not true of the Germans. They don't really have a state sponsor. Most of them are coming as indentured servants. It's kind of like temporary slaves, and they're going to be working and then work for their freedom and so forth. So we have to get others who are sending missionary pastors, if you will, to help the Germans out. And there are different institutions that do that. But one of the more important institutions that helps to send Lutheran pastors for the German Lutherans in the colonial period are the Halle institutions, the University of Halle, as well as other schools and training programs in Germany. A university had been established early 18th century, and part of its mission was to train pastors, and they sent missionaries to India, and they also sent about 25 such missionaries to North America. By the time this happens, Lutheranism has had a doctrinal theological fight internally that divides Lutherans into Pietists and Orthodox. Now, we don't have to go into that in great detail. It's a battle within Lutheranism, so that all the adherents formally subscribe to the Lutheran confessions, but they have different ideas about which elements of the Lutheran confessions are important and which aren't. And since it's the Pietists who dominate American Lutheranism in the 19th century, I'll just say a word or two, especially about the Pietists. When you have a state church, as we do now in Germany after the Reformation, everybody in the territory is a member of that church. So that means if we would go back to Saxony and just think about Saxony, if you've got a place like Wittenberg, it's not only the people who go to church who are Lutherans, it's also the people who don't go to church. When you're born, you're baptized, you're a Lutheran, and you'll remain a Lutheran, whether you believe it or not, for all of your life. It's going to take an awful lot for you to be kicked out of the Lutheran church, because it's a state church, and the state church doesn't want to create a lot of divisions and problems. It wants to create harmony, social peace, and unity. And so everybody's a member of the state church, and basically they stay a member of the state church, whether they're really very good Christians or not. So when we get to the end of the 17th century, early 18th century, there arises a movement which said, this isn't any good. We can't have people considered good members of the Lutheran Church just because they're baptized, for whom Christianity has meant nothing subsequently. They've got to be awakened to the meaning of what it means to be a Christian. And the folks who were committed then to awakening people to what it meant to be a Christian are the Pietists. And so they began to preach and to teach that it wasn't good enough just to be baptized. When you hit adulthood, you were going to have to experience what it really meant to be a damned sinner and what it really meant to be redeemed by Christ. And that should be an emotional kind of powerful movement in your life, as a result of which you are a changed person and fully committed to the Christian lifestyle. So that's the kind of Lutheranism that predominated during the colonial period. And the man who is usually thought of as the patriarch of American Lutheranism, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, was a Pietist, and who in his visiting settlements of Germans, especially in Pennsylvania, trying to organize them into churches, trying to get them to awaken to the significance of their baptism, he's preaching for this awakening. This is what he wants. This is what he's looking for, and this is the kind of Lutheran that he is. Now, he is a Lutheran, but by the time we get to the 18th century, the Augsburg Confession is kind of a piece of the furniture. It's there, you know it's there, but it's no longer kind of the heart of what it is you're interested in. You're interested in is not getting them to know the Augsburg Confession, but you're interested in getting them to awaken to the significance of their faith. And so Muhlenberg, that's how he preaches. That's what he looks for. Now, he is important. He helps to organize congregations. He tries to arrange for them to have pastors. He actually, with a handful of others, forms the first Lutheran church body. It comes to be known as the Pennsylvania Ministerium. It was organized in 1748. He helps to build churches. He's got a ton of energy, and he's good-hearted, and he's working for the establishment and maintenance of the Lutheran church here among the German Lutherans, but he's doing it from this Pietist perspective, and that is a perspective in which your Lutheranism is one thing, but being a real Christian is another thing. You've got to be awakened. In this work of establishing the Lutheran church here in America, Muhlenberg, who came from Halle, he's one of the Pietists from Halle, he's the first of about 24 who come in the colonial period from about 1742. That's when he comes to the end of the colonial period, about 23 others who come. He's concerned that German Lutherans here have become victims of unlicensed, unofficial preachers. And these are folks who kind of rose from the ranks in America. Sometimes they had been kicked out of the ministry back in the old country, and it started afresh here in the new. Other times, they really didn't have much training at all, but they were available, willing to preach, and congregations who had no pastors were willing to take them on. So Muhlenberg is really concerned about preachers like that, and he wants to make sure that his congregations have preachers who are authorized, certified, licensed, if you will. He himself had permission to preach on account of credentials from the chaplain to the King of England, who in the 18th century, just to complicate things a little bit here, was also the Duke of Hanover. So wearing his German hat, he was the head of a Lutheran state church. Wearing his English hat, he was the head of the Church of England. And so, well, in a way, it made it easier then for people like Muhlenberg to come for the German Lutherans because he could come through the credentials of the King of England. So at any rate, that's important for Muhlenberg. What's not a matter of concern for Muhlenberg is what kind of Protestant Christian you were, as long as you belonged to one of the official churches that had the blessing of the government, as opposed to one of these vagabond preachers who were doing this without license, without ordination, without permission. And so for Muhlenberg, if you were German Reformed, that was okay, and he's not going to try to convert your members. And similarly, if you were Church of England, that's okay for Muhlenberg also. So he does not have a strong doctrinal consensus. Now, I want to illustrate that here, but I wonder if we should take a little break, and then we come back, and I will...
Let's do that.
Do that.
Yeah. We are taking a look at the battle for the Augsburg Confession in 19th century America. We're getting there. We're getting there. We're just now talking about the Lutherans, colonial Lutheranism in North America. And we'll continue the conversation in just a moment with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
Concordia University Irvine, you have the freedom to explore your future and your faith. Across over 60 on-campus and online programs, you'll experience Christian education that's uniquely designed to develop the whole person, to prepare you not just for your career, but for all of your callings in life. Here you'll explore life's toughest questions, gain lifelong skills, and make relationships that last a lifetime. Concordia University Irvine. Learn more at cui.edu.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We are talking about the battle for the Augsburg Confession in 19th century America. We're on our way to 19th century America. We're talking about Lutheranism and Henry Muhlenberg and his role in Lutheranism in North America in the colonial era, I guess, is what we're looking at now. What were his concerns about the lack of seminary education and untrained preachers?
Yeah.
In the church at that time.
Right. America has a shortage of preachers, but the preachers that Muhlenberg wants are ones who are trained and authorized. He doesn't believe in just kind of raising people from the ranks because you don't know what you're going to get, and probably what you're going to get is not very good. That's kind of his position and view. Now, he and his holy pietist colleagues knew that they couldn't send everybody back to Germany. People could kind of study for the ministry by reading theology under a practicing pastor. It'd be kind of like on-the-job sort of training. And then at a certain point, they would thought to be ready, and then they would be presented to, let's say, the pastors of this Pennsylvania ministerium that I talked about that Muhlenberg had formed, kind of the first Lutheran church body. And the men would be then examined, and if they passed their examination, then they would be ordained as Lutheran pastors. So for Muhlenberg, there needed to be a process of examination and ordination rather than every congregation doing its own thing. So this was important to Muhlenberg. And he would do this as a Lutheran so that the end result would be a clergyman who could freely pledge his faithfulness to the Lutheran confessions, part of his ordination. But as I said before we took our little break, for Muhlenberg, almost more important than the doctrine was the fact that it took place under kind of official state church, the state church system. Even though the Pennsylvania Ministerium was not a state church outfit, Muhlenberg was friendly and supportive of other representatives of state church establishments who were here legally doing their work, whether they were Lutheran or not. And I want to illustrate this a little bit from his journals. Muhlenberg has left us a ton of materials from which we can assess his activities. At one point, he talks about the dedication of a new church in Philadelphia. This is a dedication of Zion Lutheran Church. And he describes the dedication service that he says, "This church is dedicated to the triune God, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, for the use of the German Evangelical Lutheran congregation, which professes the pure evangelical doctrine on the foundation of the apostles and prophets and the two holy sacraments instituted by Christ," and here's the operative word for us, "according to the unaltered Augsburg Confession and the other symbolical books." Now, this is great, and I'm all for it, but then as you read on about the dedication of this church, we have other statements here about, well, okay, they're having the German service in the morning, but in the afternoon, they're going to have an English service, and the English service will feature an address by Reverend Mr. Peters, and he is the representative of the Church of England in Philadelphia. So you've got dedication of a Lutheran church in which one of the services will feature the preaching of an Anglican pastor. At another point, Muhlenberg talks about a fight in a congregation, and this is one of the things that these early pastors often had to do, and that was to kind of act as umpires for congregations who got mad at their pastor or pastors who got mad at their congregation. So Muhlenberg or others like him would come in and try to settle the dispute. And one dispute had to do with a Lutheran teacher, a catechist, and he had gotten into exchanging some angry words with German Reformed. It was a new congregation in the Blue Mountains, and now I'm here quoting Muhlenberg here. And he says, "The people of both denominations, Lutherans and Reformed, are intermarried, and this causes sad dissension and harm if the ministers on both sides will not forbear one another and be examples to the flock." So Muhlenberg says, "I had to admonish Mr. Enderlin, the catechist, to love because Enderlin has been refuting the Heidelberg Catechism." And this broke down the relationships, the harmonious relationships that existed between the Lutherans and the Reformed pastors and congregations. So again, Muhlenberg is less concerned with Lutheran doctrine than he is with awakened Christians who learn to live in harmony with other forms of Christianity. So my point is, in terms of the Augsburg Confession, it's here in Muhlenberg's stuff, but it's not the focal point of his ministry, because if you're an awakened Christian, well, that's good enough. We're not going to worry about whether you're Lutheran or Reformed or Anglican. So there's a minimalization of the Augsburg Confession. It's a part of what makes you a Lutheran, but it's not all that important whether you be a Lutheran or not, as long as you are awakened. So there's a way in which the Augsburg Confession has been reduced in its significance, especially here in a pietist ministry, which is going to make it problematical for what are the Lutherans going to do when they no longer have people from the old world coming in order to continue the Lutheran church. And that's exactly the problem that happens. And I'll just begin this here before we get into our series for next time. The American Revolution comes along and it's successful, of course, but in its success, it really is cut off from the old world. There aren't a whole lot of people in continental Europe who are all that thrilled with the Reformation. not the Reformation, the Revolution. You know, you still have kings, dukes, etc. in Germany, Switzerland, Sweden, Scandinavia, as well as England. And they think of the Americans as this kind of revolutionary radical rabble type. So we don't get a lot of immigration of Germans or Swedes or anything. And we also get kind of a cutoff of the churches sending missionaries. So there's no, there are no more holy men after 1792. There are no more Swedish Lutheran pastors who are being sent by the king. The Americans are kind of on their own, and being on their own, they're going to have to decide for themselves as to how important old world Christianity with all its ceremonies, all its confessions, all its seminary training, whether that's important in the new American, new nation. In fact, we can close this off with one little anecdote. The Swedish Lutheran congregations along the Delaware River, they had become pretty anglicized by the time of the American Revolution. And when the Swedes quit sending Swedish Lutheran pastors to care for them, they decided that they were going to give up their Lutheranism, and they all became Anglican. That was the thing to do because they were speaking English. Episcopalian was the religion of the English. And so without Lutheran pastors, they just went all the way to a non-Lutheran denomination. So the question is, what's going to happen to the Lutherans who had been established by Muhlenberg and other pietists when they no longer have reinforcements coming from the old country, no longer have pastors coming from the old country? What's going to happen to the Lutheran Church when we get to this new American nation? And that's something I think your listeners will find interesting when we get to it on the next episode.
I know I find it interesting. I am looking forward to that next episode. This has been so interesting, hearing all of this history about Lutheranism in early America. Dr. McKenzie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're very welcome. I look forward to carrying on our conversation next time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, the Forrest E. and Francis H. Ellis Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I come back next week for part three of this series. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm